my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Yanis Varoufakis and to welcome him on behalf of the Institute for European Studies and the Tocqueville Program, who are the co-sponsors of this event. And many thanks to Tim Helwig and Aurelian for their support for this talk. Dr. Varoufakis is a professor of economic theory at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs in the University of Texas at Austin. Prior to that, he has a long, distinguished teaching career. He was at the University of Athens. He taught at the University of Sydney in Australia and at several places in England, the University of Essex, the University of East Anglia, and was a visiting fellow at the University of Cambridge for a year as well. Dr. Varoufakis has been a major figure in Greek public life since the dawn of the economic crisis 5 years ago now. He has played a major role in critiquing governmental policies, critiquing them correctly, in my humble opinion, and pushing debates about how the Eurozone crisis can be solved further forward. It's my tremendous pleasure to welcome him here. He will be giving another lecture tomorrow night. If anyone is interested, you can talk to me. This will be part of the Modern Greek Studies Association Symposium, which we are hosting this weekend. If you are interested in hearing more from Dr. Varoufakis, talk to me after the presentation. I'll be happy to let you know how that can happen. Anyways, Yanni, I'll give you the stage. Welcome to Indiana University, and welcome to the Neil Marshall Cultural Center. We look forward to hearing your talk.
Thank you very much, Frank. Thank you. A big thank you to everyone who participated in organizing my visit here. It's an honor and a privilege to be in your midst. To all of you for taking the time to be here. What can an economist possibly have to say about democracy? I mean, usually not much, except for several toxic ideas which are better left unsaid, such as, you know, those infuriating, at least to me, comparisons between market choices and electoral choices, whereby we teach our students that you know, whenever you buy yogurt, you're effectively voting in favor of that particular brand, using instead of votes, you know, your dollars, and that the two processes, the political process and the market process, are not too dissimilar, except for, of course, in the economic process, you can vote very frequently if you have lots of money. You won't be hearing any of this from me today, except as a warning of, you know, for political scientists, that the sirens of economics should be left unheard. Just use lots of wax in your ears and tie yourself to imaginary masts. But let me begin at the beginning. Right. Let's take democracy, ruled by the demos. Going back to ancient Athens, the Athenians did not discover majority rule. They did not discover slavery, and they did not discover sexism, gender discrimination. All these were part and parcel of Athenian democracy. Right? Women didn't vote. The foreigners didn't vote, migrants didn't vote, and slaves didn't vote. Majority rule was practiced, but this is not what made Athenian democracy special, and special in a way which I think speaks to us and to our present predicament in an interesting way. What made it special was the concept of isigoria, or isigoria. The idea that, I mean, if you look at Aristotle's definition of democracy in politics, 1290, something like that, he defines it as a constitution, a polity, where the majority decision, and therefore power to collective decision-making, falls with the poor. That your economic power does not affect your capacity to influence the polis decision. Now, in that sense of democracy, which is an exceptionally radical sense, right, we don't have democracies today. Today, what we would have, at least from Aristotle's perspective, is either constitutional or, if you want, constrained oligarchies. You will recall that in ancient Athens, to be rhetorically skilled was frowned upon. Why? Because it was a threat to Isagoria, a threat to the idea that arguments should carry weight independently of who utters them, of the skills with which one utters them, whether rhetorical skills, how wealthy, how important, how beautiful, how handsome the speaker was. So in that very short-lived and fragile flower that was Athenian democracy, and in spite of its hideousness in many respects, the fact that they were warmongers, the fact that they were sexist, the fact that they kept slaves, nevertheless, there was this very important innovation, the idea that you can be dirt poor as long as you were a male citizen, and your views had to carry weight that was independent of who you were. Now, in that sense, our liberal democracies, which came out of a Protestant ethic, and you can take it all the way to Magna Carta, are a very different beast, a very different animal, in the sense that in ancient Athens, the demos was the state. There was no question of legitimizing state action on the basis of consent. The demos was a state. Whereas ever since we discovered the people as, in English, as an alternative to the demos, effectively, just reading the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton and so on, you'll find that it's very clearly a project for invoking the people in order to create a stable system of government in which the people would have very little direct control. And as Hamilton puts it, it is the merchants and their representatives that should be representing all of the other classes in society. That's a very different concept to the one that the ancient Athenians had. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because our democracies today are facing a number of threats. They're imperiled to a very large extent by voter apathy, by citizens who would very readily, given a chance, sell their right to vote and to participate in politics at depressingly low prices. Mm-hmm. And there are other threats. This has been a threat now for 30 years almost in the West. But ever since we had the Wall Street collapse in 2008, which has cascaded into a sequence of crises the world over, and of course Europe being the epicenter of one of these crises. Since 2008, the threats to democracy and to the idea of rule by the people for the people and so on and so forth have magnified, as far as I'm concerned. Add to that technological innovations, which can be whose impact is very hard to gauge at the moment, but which, at least in some of their dimensions, pose serious problems, serious threats to democracy. And I think we have enough to discuss on the basis of these historical developments and also conceptual problems. We have plenty to talk about regarding democracy. Now, going back to this idea of Aristotle, but also of Plato, who was, of course, a fierce anti-democrat. Right? The idea that democracy is about giving an opportunity to the weak of society, to the poor, to have isagoria. Come to think of this. The only way that that may happen is if the political and the economic spheres are very heavily intertwined. However, over the last 30 years, think of what's been happening in the United States and in Europe in particular. These two spheres have been decoupling. To put it differently, If you were Prime Minister of Italy, Chancellor of Germany, President of France, or indeed President of the United States, 30 years ago, you had a lot more levers of power than you would have today. Political goods have been devaluing very heavily over the last 30 years. To be a little bit more precise and allow my economic determinism, which I'm trying to really keep down, to suppress it, but nevertheless, one cannot go against one's nature, or predilection for that matter. Let me locate a pivotal moment in around 1971, 15th of August, to be precise, when President Richard Nixon announced the end of the first post-war phase, the so-called Bretton Woods period, and all hell broke loose, at least in the economic sphere. Banks, which were a genie kept quite effectively within a bottle, were allowed to run riot, and the era of financialization began. Up until then, if you look at inequality, if you look at income inequality, if you look at wealth inequality, if you look at the balance of power between politicians, the President of the United States, let's say, the Secretary of the Treasury, and J.P. Morgan, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, okay? That was a much more evenly balanced game back then. Now, exactly what happened is the topic of another lecture, and I can very easily slip into talking about it, but I am going to restrain myself and not do it. But the point I'm making is that political goods have been devaluing in inverse proportion to the success of the financial sector in arresting social and economic power from the rest of society. And by that, I don't mean just from the poor and the middle classes, but also from industrial capital. So once upon a time, Ford Motor Company, General Motors, was far more significant a player within the capitalist game than they are today. Today, had President Obama allowed General Motors to die, it would have been probably a bad thing, but it would not have really changed the face of America today. But if General Motors had died in 1953 or 1963, it would have been a very different situation. So as the financial sector, financial goods, get massively overvalued relative to political goods, that old Hamiltonian penchant for keeping the masses in their place and making sure that it was the merchants that were effectively the agents of representative government, that has slipped. Because the merchants themselves are losing power. And even those merchants who manage to influence through lobbying, through even getting elected themselves in office, find themselves that they are in the cockpit of an airplane where the levers are not working anymore. They keep pulling them, nothing happens. The plane is on automatic pilot, and the algorithm of the automatic pilot is determined by global financial markets. So that has been the case now for 30 years. Now, I often hear, and I'm sure you hear this too, that I mentioned it right at the beginning of my talk about apathy. Apathy being the great failure of democracy, of liberal democracies. That, we have an apathetic populace, people don't want to vote. In the States, for instance, you know better than me, the proportion of citizens who vote is depressing. But it's falling everywhere. It's falling even in countries where almost 95% of those with the right to vote exercised it. So it's a generalized, a universal condition. The provocative point I shall make right now is that this is not a failure of the system of representative government we have. It's a design feature of it. The moment you have a system as designed back then, I'm talking about the late 18th and the 19th centuries, and then spread in the 20th century far and wide, with very good effect. I'm not I don't want to detract from the importance of the spread of liberal democracies. But what I'm saying is that the idea of representative democracy as a means of ensuring that direct control of the levers of power is denied those who Aristotle used to call ivanovsi, the vulgar. In conjunction with financialization, could have only one effect, and that is apathy. Not only apathy amongst the vanovsi, the vulgar, but also amongst the graduates of Harvard Business School, of Yale Law School, of the Ivy League universities, because let's face it, young people who have been privileged enough to graduate from these schools into power, they do not want to be powerless. And these days, with the diminution of political goods, Wall Street is the place for them to go, and not Capitol Hill. That same process of financialization, which was diminishing the worth of political goods, was exactly the same process that led to the implosion of the fall of 2008. It's precisely the same process. The same process that led to the creation of mountains of toxic derivatives, which then combusted, burning down Wall Street in 2008, was the same process which had effectively rendered political goods immaterial. And then what happens? Now we have a very interesting development. It's what I call an inverted Darwinian process. When I was growing up and, you know, participating in political debates between the left and the right, the social democratic left, liberals as you call them in the United States, and libertarians or free marketeers. The free marketeer neoliberal argument was that a market society which is untrammeled and unimpeded by government intervention is a fine Darwinian evolutionary process which selects for the fittest. It makes sure that all the corrupt, the less efficient practices become extinct like dinosaurs. So effectively society, without there being a planner to tell us what to do, selects for the best practices, for the best products, creates new vistas of pleasure and consumption, and promotes growth, and so on and so on. That was the right-wing argument, right? The Darwinian argument. The argument from the liberals, from the center-left, from the social democrats was that, you know, it took us thousands of years, or millions of years, to escape the jungle. We don't want to go back to the jungle. And, you know, the John Rawls argument about, you know, justice not being a natural product of liberal democracies in which the state is not intervening. Now, in 1991, between 89 and 91, the tide went out on the left with the collapse of the Soviet Union, which, interestingly, took down with it not just the communist ideals and ideology, but also many of those who had opposed communism, but who had stood for a social democratic kind of arrangement, the mixed economy, if you want. But in 2008, what we lost was the libertarian tradition. I mean, unbeknownst, of course, to the libertarians, we haven't realized that. What has really happened is that the Darwinian process is clearly evident, only it is inverted. Now we live in a social economy where the more inefficient you are, the greater the black hole in your accounting books, the more bankrupt you are, as long as you're a banker, the greater your social power over everyone else, and the greater your capacity to extract rents, profits, surpluses, from everybody else. This is something that has happened, began to happen in the 1990s in Japan. And we in the United States and in Europe used to consider the Japanese to have been completely inane for having allowed for the zombification of their banking system. Okay? The living dead bankers who were feasting on the flesh and blood of Japanese society. And yet, after 2008, what did we do? Exactly the same, both here in the United States and in Europe. Only worse. Only at, you know, sort of, it was a turbocharged version of what happened in Japan. And, but let me not just blame it on the bankers here, or the politicians who were in cahoots with them. Now I want to turn a self-critical gaze at my own profession. Look at economics. Now, I'm going to be saying tomorrow in my talk, allow me to publicize this a bit, to market it, that economics is nothing more than superstition with equations. And if you want, mythology with equations. But it's the same thing, just that mythology is elegant and philologically pleasing superstition with equations. Why was it believed? The reason why it was believed was because there was a lot of money to be made by those who used the mathematized superstitions of my profession and those who used them. Politicians, behind every toxic macroeconomic policy, there was some economic model by some Nobel laureate. That's not true, by the way, because you know that the Nobel Prize in economics is not real. It's fake. But anyway, let's call them Nobel Prize winners in economics. And every toxic derivative produced by Lehman Brothers, by J.P. Morgan, by Goldman Sachs, had some mathematical model behind it. Beautiful, aesthetically gorgeous mathematical model, which was, of course, completely wrong and very dangerous, because that's why it's like, you know, you give a large hammer to a small child, you end up with a lot of damage. This is precisely what was going on. It's not the hammer's fault. The mathematical model was beautiful. It's just that it should never have been used to price those derivatives because it couldn't. Or it could, as long as we assume that there can never be a crisis, which is, you know, it's like having an airbag in your car, which works perfectly as long as you don't have an accident. So, now, let me refer to the conjunction between economic theory and policy under the aegis and the dark clouds of Wall Street. Two names, the Prince of Darkness, Professor Larry Summers of Harvard, and Tim Geithner. The people, you know, Tim Geithner, I have heard him say this with my own ears back in the 90s when he was an underling in the Clinton administration under Summers. He said that he does not believe that the Fed's job is to regulate Wall Street. Larry Summers actively destroyed the Glass-Steagall Act, which was impeding to some extent financialization, which I think is important from the perspective of democracy, if what I was saying in my introduction is important, that financialization is the other side of the diminution of the value of political goods and therefore the diminution of democracy. Right? Now, Obama wins in 2008, is installed in 2009, and who does he bring back into government in order to sort out the mess? Larry Summers and Tim Geithner. Now, if you were to ask President Obama why he did that, I think he may have a convincing answer. Because only those who actually created that mess understand its intricacy. So that is another example of the inverted Darwinism. Because Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, very clever people. I have no doubt that they're very clever people. And in some, the most infuriating thing is that if you were to have Larry Summers here to talk to you about what's happening today, he'd probably give you an excellent lecture, which would be very informative too, right? But these people, in any well-functioning democracy, should have been covered in tar and feathers. after what they did in the 1990s. And yet, they were brought back into government as saviors. Just like the bankers who lost the greatest amount of money were the ones that exercised and still exercise the most significant social power over all of us. So failure in the last few years has acquired the whiff of success. And bankruptcy imparts power. Now, President Obama had a moment, a very small window of opportunity in 2008, radically to restore the principles of democracy that should be returning power to the demos and also ensuring that Darwinism is not stood on its head, both in Wall Street, in academia, and in his own Treasury Department, in the Fed, and so on and so forth. When progressive radicalism is not exercised, what happens? It gives rise to anti-democratic radicalism. And this is what we've been observing in the United States. This gross assault on the idea of democratic government, because this is what the Republican position is these days. You know, when we say that, you know, we all that matters is a reduction, you know, what I call debt fetishism, in the middle of a recession, as if we didn't learn the lesson of the 1930s. And you do it in a way, and this is the anti-democratic radicalism part. Because a lot of what they say makes perfect sense. It is true that Wall Street has been given bailouts by the Obama administration. I just said it myself about Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, right? It is completely true that nobody went to prison after the world's greatest financial frauds were perpetrated, even though under the Republicans, when the SNL scandal broke out, 1,000 people went to prison. And that was nothing. That was just a walk in the park compared to what happened in, you know, a few years ago. So that it is completely right that we don't live in a democracy, but we live in an oligarchy, as I put it, where the oligarchs are back-scratching mutually one another, the revolving doors. And yet the conclusion of that, that what we need is effectively to shut down government, is the opposite of what is necessary in order to restore democracy. That is, the rule of the demos. Because don't forget that the whole point about democracy was that it was not just a talking shop where we all had, you know, the equivalent of Twitter on Pnika, the hill of Pnika, which is where the ancient Athenian assembly gathered. It's important to have freedom of speech. It's crucial in any society which is worth being a member of. But that is not democracy. Democracy is about decisions. About decisions regarding collective action. About taxation. About common projects to which, you know, there will always be a minority that says no to them. So, let me, since I've said a few words about the United States, let me now take you to Europe, which is at the forefront of my concerns and consternation at the moment, for reasons that I think I don't need to elaborate. Now, in Europe, I come from a country, let me just make it very personal, which in the 1940s, together with the Yugoslavs, put up the most fierce resistance to the Nazis, and that had the highest per capita loss of life and limb to the Nazis. Now, this is a country which now has a Nazi party that would, in my estimation, get 15% of the vote and would be the third largest party in Parliament. Now, what has happened? How could that be? That party was non-existent 2 years ago. Well, the lesson we've learned from the 1930s, and generally speaking, from the 1920s, the lesson we learned from German history, is that when you have a nation humiliated and its middle class, its citizens, see absolutely no way out through democratic processes, they see no possibility that even if they elect good representatives, honest representatives, that some genuine change can be effected that will give their kids a chance to live in a decent society. Well, then the serpent's egg begins to hatch. Especially in this climate of humiliation. Now, why did that happen in Europe? Well, remember what I was saying about our liberal democracies not being about rule of the demos, but being about bypassing direct control over the levers of power of the demos and effectively turning what the Athenians described as democracy into a consultation process. In my mind, I don't know about those colleagues of mine in university, know very well that the opposite of democracy in university governance is consultation. Right? It may sound democratic, but it isn't. It's precisely the opposite thing. You know, a hegemon consults. And that's what reinforces his hegemony. And this is what kills off democracy. Now, in Europe, we created the European Union back in the early 1950s. Under the auspices of the New Dealers, by the way, the Roosevelt and Truman administration, who had their own wholly understandable agenda. But in Europe, the Central Europeans invented a very interesting term, the Europe of Nations. Those of you who are involved in European studies will remember, Jean Monnet was talking about the Europe of Nations. Now, that's not the same thing as the Europe of democracies. It is precisely the opposite. And if you read very carefully Jean Monnet, who is one of the fathers of the European Union, diaries and personal memos and speeches, you'll find that he was quite platonic in his enmity towards democracy, towards liberal democracy. And of course, not even an iota of a thought about direct democracy. If you look at the way that the European Union has been structured, it's been structured as if, in order to design out of it, any democratic control over policy. While Europe was growing economically, the different nation states embedded within it could function in a way that simulated nicely liberal democracies like the United States. But what was interesting is this amazing process of integrating different nations, different countries that were separated by so very different languages and cultures. That process of integration, which was remarkable, was jeopardized by a common currency, which is now threatening to divide us. Once we blended our economies monetarily by means of a monetary union, effectively we set in motion a process whereby two things happened. Firstly, the economies that were blended together were put on a course towards destabilization. This is what happened in the international economy in the 1920s and 30s with the gold standard. The gold standard was a common currency of the era. Once you fixed the exchange rates and you fixed everything, all those exchange rates with gold, what happens is a social market economy, an international one, that resembles invading Russia. A great beginning at first, full of hope and glory, which eventually gets ground down by a very ugly winter until you have blood on the snow. What happens is you have massive capital flows from the surplus areas or countries to the deficit countries. That creates bubbles, a semblance of growth, then the bubbles burst, and then the capital that has flowed into the deficit regions or countries floods out, and those deficit countries or states or regions become the place that Steinbeck writes his Grapes of Wrath about. This is what's happening in Europe. So that was at the economic level. At the democratic level, we now in Europe have governments that have absolutely zilch power, even to enact a new tax bill. We have a so-called troika of lenders, because this is what happens when bubbles burst. You have unpayable debts, and then you have loans that are given to the bankrupt, just like the bailouts of Wall Street. The only difference is that unlike Wall Street, which has the political power as well, the bankrupt in Europe, in Southern Europe, have none. So effectively, they are forced to take loans, which they can never repay. It is a common secret they can never repay. So what you end up is a combination of debt prison for proud nations and the Victorian poorhouse for large segments of Europe's population. Naturally, democracy has no place to breathe in there. The final chapter on democracy that I want to open up and close it very quickly so that we can and, you know, go into a discussion concerns the long term. What I described so far was, you know, the last 30, 40 years or so, the last 5 years, both in the United States and in Europe. Now I want to talk about the future. Because if Aristotle was right, and if the ancient Athenians were correct, that the essence of democracy is isigoureia, it is the opportunity of the weak, of the poor, to make their views heard about what the collectivity should be doing. Then we need to find some way of re-blending political and economic power, which now have completely and utterly decoupled. And the only way that that's going to happen is through technology. Technology has been doing this now since the inception of capitalism, right? Now, one of the reasons, again, you will excuse my economic determinism, one of the reasons why Britain, where the first industrial revolution took place, shifted towards liberal democracy is coal mines. Because coal mines created the physical space in which lots of poor people could get together and could organize unions and push for social reform. Oil, on the other hand, is an anti-democratic source of energy simply because you don't need that many people in the same space in order to produce it. So it's much more prone to divide and rule. Today, we have information technology and 3D printing. Now, there are many, and understandably, prophets of wonderful things to come regarding e-democracy. Because now we do have the internet. We have social media, which allow us to imagine a world in which we could even go back to Athenian direct democracy. Because the argument against Athenian democracy is that there's simply not, there's no such thing as a large enough hill of Pnyca where we can all congregate and make decisions together. But technology changes that. So there are these great and wonderful prophecies about what technology can do to assist in a reconstitution of the demos that was suffered so badly at the hands of the people, which is the alternative in my narrative to demos. Also, there is another very important development, and I mentioned that in 3D printing. The point I'm making is this. Now, what was it that gave Henry Ford immense power? Economies of scale. Together with Taylorism, Fordism, created barriers to entry, very large monopoly power or oligopoly power for Mr. Ford, for, you know, General Electric, for the large conglomerates, the industrialists, of that created the first networked firms, Edison. And it was these fixed costs with falling average costs, which made sure that they became effectively natural oligopolies. So you had oligarchy in politics and oligopoly in economics. Adam Smith became just a very nice myth, which was added on in order to provide ideological legitimacy to what was going on, which was very different to anything that Adam Smith would have ever approved of, by the way. Now, marginal costs tend to zero. And they tend to be equalized with average costs. And fixed costs of production are also shrinking very, very fast. So in effect, you know, if you have a good idea, you have some computer skills, you can produce a blueprint, and then you sell the blueprint, and somebody can 3D print it in their locality. You cut out the middleman, you cut out the transportation costs. You don't need a network. You are General Motors and Apple's greatest nightmare in the long run. Now, that could be a democratizing influence of technology. It could effectively spell the end of corporate power, which in turn might, I'm not being deterministic here, might give democracy another chance. But on the other hand, the very same technology operates in the opposite direction, in the sense that the capacity of the nation state to tax for the purposes of effecting collectively decided policy withers. With Ireland and the various tax havens and very smart accountants, corporate power may be threatened by technology, but on the other hand, they use the extermination of distance and the lowering of borders in order to create circumstances whereby collective decisions may be reached but not be able to be affected due to lack of a tax base. I have no prognosis as to what's going to happen. What I'm saying, and I'll leave it there, is two things. Firstly, the fragile flower that is democracy has been trampled upon, not by accident, but by design, by a system that has effectively allowed itself, just like Dr. Frankenstein allowed the thing, the beast, his creation to run riot and effectively, and in the end kill him, we've let the financial genie out of the bottle, and we did not use the opportunity of 2008 to put it back. That is a catastrophe for democracy at a planetary level. We may be able to do it in the future. Perhaps we need another crisis like 2008 before we learn the lessons that we didn't learn in 2008. That's the first thing. Second thing is, technology is moving in ways that at once give us a chance to reconstitute democracy and to undermine it. So I suppose it's a work in progress.